Welcome to Real Stories, a show that has honest conversations from the heart. I invite you to sit back, relax, and allow our guests to speak their truth.
Hello, I'm Taylor the Communication Doctor, and welcome to Real Stories. I just want to say, I come from a family where people didn't always speak their truth. And I think it's so important to speak their truth. And every day I meet people who, because of society, are just walking with that facade because they feel that it is the way to be. And in Real Stories, I want people to know the real story behind the facade. And that is why I do what I do. Hello, this is Real Stories, and I am your host, Tanya the Communication Doctor. And today on my show, I have Sahana Chattopathy, and she is a speaker, a story seeker, and a consultant. Welcome, Sahana.
Thank you, Tanya. Thank you for that beautiful introduction.
It's just lovely to have you on my show. I had to work out how to say Chattopathy, but we got there in the end.
Fine.
Oh, yeah. And you know what I love? Just when I was reading out your title, I love the fact that you're a story seeker. Because that's quite interesting, even that language, you know? Not a storyteller, but a story seeker. Can you explain a little bit more about that to my audience, please?
Sure. I think as far back as I can remember, right into my childhood, I've absolutely loved reading. I mean, many people love reading, but for me, as a single child with a mother who wasn't always so well, I know, and we owned a bookshop. My dad owned a bookshop.
Oh.
So my books became my, I would say, heaven, my refuge, my friends, and most importantly, I think windows into many, many worlds that, you know, that expanded not only my imagination, but my horizon internally and externally. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I lived my life with Scarlett O'Hara and the, all the Good Wives and the Little Women. And I don't know, I think I just grew up with my characters, right from Enid Blyton to Margaret O'Michelle. They became my friends. So I think I carried that into adulthood. I mean, I love reading passionately, but I also discovered gradually as a professional facilitator, coach, and an organization development professional, I also discovered that, you know, stories lie in those folds and cracks of uniformity. So what you see as apparently uniform and linear and regular and kind of tabulated and quantified in numbers and data and statistics only, I think, show you a slice of the picture. Yeah. But when you hear the different narratives and stories that are interwoven, that stories have the capacity to hold multiple perspectives, yes, that data and statistics and numbers do not. So when I hear stories from real people, from the world, I begin to get a glimpse of the multiplicity and the interwovenness of life, the web of life, if you will. And I think that's what made me from loving reading stories to listening and seeking out stories and narratives that then, you know, sort of weave together. I can interweave. I'm also a pattern seeker. Stories show me the bigger patterns.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's why I'm a story seeker.
You know, it's so interesting. It's just an interesting language in terms of how you put it, you know,
In terms of being a seeker, in terms of my perception of what a seeker is, because it's almost like you're delving a little bit deeper. You're not just reading, but you're delving deeper. And as you quite rightly said, when we look at people's stories, we look at perception. And I suppose one of the reasons why I do real stories is because I want to get that real stories. But in every story, there is a real story. And I suppose in every story, different people have different perceptions and take different things away from it. But it's a way of growth. And I feel it's a way of healing and a way of development. And I just wanted to tap into that idea of seeking. It's almost like seeking truth, looking deeper. That's how I saw it. So it was so beautifully put as you explained a little bit of your childhood as a child, you know, how you fell in love with very, it's interesting, very Western. All the authors that you mentioned were very Western stories. And you're there and you're in Mumbai. I'd like to get a piece of Mumbai from this real story. So I'm going to go back and I'm going to ask you a little bit about stories from your kind of cultural background. And because you love stories, I want to ask you what was one of your favourite stories. And I'm going to ask, this might be a bit cheeky of me, but I'm going to ask you from the perspective of growing up in Mumbai and maybe some of those stories that maybe aren't the Western stories, because we hear about them all the time.
Thank you for asking that question, because that really unravels my story of being an Indian and being born in India. So I grew up in Calcutta, like I told you, and I shifted to Mumbai during my college years. The funny part is I grew up in post-independence India in the 70s and 80s. But I went to a school that was very, very British. So I learned English as my first language and my mother tongue as my second language. And as you very rightly pointed out that my authors are very Western, because I naturally gravitated towards them, because that's the language I'm comfortable in. So even today, I have to think in English before I can say what I mean in my mother tongue.
Oh,
which causes me to, you know, sort of tread two worlds, one in a physical sense and one in a emotional, psychological, you know. So I'm as much at home with an Enid Blyton character as other Bengali children's authors that I grew up reading. So yes, there were authors that I grew up reading, authors like the very famous Satyajit Ray, who made beautiful films. One of my very favorite books right from childhood and today also is a book called which is written in Bengali, which is my mother tongue, and has been translated into English as well, called Pother Panchali, The Song of the Road. And that is also made into a film which won absolute international acclaim and is one of the top films in the global realm even today. So for me, that is, I would say, iconic of India, the rural India of two brothers and sisters, as in two siblings, growing up together in a very poor household, struggling to be fed every day, yet the little joys of childhood do not escape them. And one of the iconic scenes in that book, which captures the India of villages, the India of childhood innocence, the India of imagination, but also the India of poverty, are these two children running through rice fields and grass, and you know, fields of grass, to see a train, because they've never seen a train before.
I love it. Yes.
So yes, that's still one of my favorite books from my culture.
I love it. And as you're speaking there, I'm just feeling that, you know, we looked at the story seeker thing, but also sometimes stories are a way of escaping world and escape in what's going on in our lives, isn't it? You know, and films as well, and that escape from everything else. And growing up in Mumbai and growing up and experiencing what you've experienced, what has been one of your biggest challenges?
So I think as a child, with books as my refuge, and I loved school, I didn't really face quote-unquote challenges as such. We were a normal middle-class family.
Mm.
I think my challenges came when I got married.
Okay.
And I got married into a very regular middle-class household, nothing different, nothing extraordinary by Indian standards. But today, when I look back in hindsight and with my ability to sort of, you know, unravel the layers, I can see how the books I read shaped who I am into, and when I got married into a very typical Indian middle-class household, mm-hmm. those notions of who I am with who I'm expected to be clashed. And I couldn't quite express it in those times. I was very young. I was like 18 or 19 when I got married.
Yeah.
So I couldn't quite understand the shift that was happening, and I didn't have words to express or analyze the shifts. But as the years progressed and I had my daughter, a beautiful baby, I enjoyed my life, and yet I did not. I felt like I was leading dual lives, one that was, you know, was expected of me, and one in my heart and head, which was not in alignment.
Yeah.
And the more I sort of got exposed, and those were not the days of the internet. So these were pre-internet, pre-mobile phone days, right?
Yeah.
At least in India, India of the 90s, early 90s, mid 90s. And so the more I sort of dwelt in that, I realized that my autonomy loving, individualistic, my respect for myself, were all hitting against this notion of what is expected of a woman in Indian society. And I was internally rebelling against that. And the more that challenge sort of became clearer to me, I realized there is more to life than being a wife and a mother and a daughter. And I mean, those are roles I'm playing, but there is more to me.
Yes.
And that is what I wanted to explore and express. And that led me to sort of, you know, do my master's again from the University of London, Goldsmith College. I then went on to enter the corporate world pretty late by, you know, age-wise, by standards. But then I didn't quite care. I wanted to explore a different world. And that's what took me to the corporate world, to the space of organization development, learning and development, leadership development. And that then began a whole different journey of rediscovering and refinding and also losing myself, another phase.
That's really interesting, because you know, you talked about also being a mother and being a wife at such a young age, because you said you were 19, 20 when you were a wife, and having
when I was married, yeah,
expectations, and there's an expectation of you, isn't there, you know, when you are a wife. I suppose culturally there's an expectation on how an Indian woman needs, or they would say need to be, it's not my words, needs to be.
Yep.
And then for you to then go and say, you know what, I want more, and to go to England and go to Goldsmith and explore, you know, another avenue. Were there any challenges there? Because obviously you're looking for escapism, but did you experience any racism? Did you experience, what did you experience actually?
Here's the interesting bit. I didn't go to England. I came across this master's degree course at the British Council Library.
Yeah.
And when I explored that, they expected me obviously to travel and study. So I, when I applied, they said, you have to live here and do it for the next whatever years. So I said, I have a young daughter, I cannot do that. And it wasn't a distance course. So I don't know. I think the universe was synchronizing on my behalf. And the dean wrote back to me saying, write to me and tell us why we should let you do this through distance. So I had nothing to lose, really. So I wrote them a long letter saying, what is it that I was expecting? What is it that I wanted to do? And why, if they let me do it via distance, I can do it. If not, I can't. I don't know what was there in my letter or in the universe. They agreed. So I did that from Mumbai by myself. And every year, an examiner would come down. And my exam of the sole examinee would be held at the British High Commission in Mumbai, Nariman Point. And I would he would get the question paper all sealed. He would break it in front of me. I would answer, write my answers. He would fold it, seal it, stamp it, get me to sign it. And this happened for 4 years till I completed my
master's. Oh, wow. So I totally misunderstood. So I thought that when you said you went to Goldsmiths, that you actually went, but you went to Goldsmiths, but you did the course in Mumbai.
I did the course. I finished it. And I think that challenge also challenged me to sort of, you know, do. So one of the warnings, quote unquote, I had been given by the dean was that this is a difficult course for you to take by yourself. You won't have professors, you won't have, you know, students with you, peers to learn from. Can you do it? And that challenge, I think, forced me to expand not only my intellectual capacity, my perseverance, but also my ability to, I think, hold space for really difficult study by myself without caving in. So it was multiple challenges at multiple levels. And so once I came out of it on the other side, I think it was a kind of, I'd stretched all my different muscles in different ways. So yeah.
And did you get a chance to come to that when you graduated? Did you get a chance to come to England?
I went later after, once I took up a corporate job, I went to England multiple times for work. I visited the college. So it was like, you know, this stretch kind of stretched me, took me to the other side, and also opened windows for me that may not have been.
So I didn't catch it. So you said that you went to England and it opened doors for you that you may not have, but I think.
Yeah, so after I completed my master's, I joined the corporate world. Yeah. And through the course of my work, I visited many, many parts of the globe. And I went to London several times. And I think this journey, this course, kind of opened windows for me that would not have been there if I had not made this, taken this leap of faith, if you will.
Yeah, no, I could totally understand that. Sometimes it does take that, doesn't it? When you go to different places and you travel, there's always opportunities, isn't there? And I suppose it looks like you saw those opportunities. Yeah. And also, there's so much learning culturally, isn't it? Because everyone lives their life in a very different way and you experience someone else's culture. That's why I always think it's good to travel. Some people travel and they may not come out of their resort. There's no point to that, is there? But it's always good.
I love to travel.
Yeah, and to connect with people. So when you travel, it's almost like connecting with the people and connecting with their way of life and their food and their culture, because that's really kind of experiencing it rather than going to a resort and staying in a resort and not really engaging. But, you know, like coming to London, I suppose, is an interesting thing, you know, obviously because of the city as well, and culturally so different as well from Mumbai. So it's interesting you said, you know, that you took so much from it, you know, as a person. But you're also a lover of, I know you're a lover of the earth, and you're a lover of, you know, intuition and nature. How did you kind of become to be that way? Was this just something that was just the way you are or the way you are? People always love the earth. And also, how did you become to be that way? And what do you feel about what's happening now in terms of the world and climate change and the way that we're destroying everything?
It's kind of beyond tragic what is happening now. Yeah. And how did I come to love the earth? So again, it goes back to my childhood. I grew up with reading books, like I said, and one of my favorite authors, two of my favorite authors, were James Herriot and Gerald Durrell.
Yes.
Writing about animals. So for the longest time, I wanted to be a vet.
Oh. Okay.
And I just wanted to spend my life with animals. And when I was a teenager, I actually wrote to Gerald Durrell's Jersey Wildlife Fund seeking a job. And they wrote back very kindly saying, you're too young. But yeah, I was that, I mean, I wanted to be a zookeeper or something, but something to do with animals, just to be close to them.
Yeah.
And so that carried over. And I've always, always loved nature. I'm also a trained naturalist. And so I've traveled across all the forests in India till I realized that people are just kind of, you know, going to forests to, I don't know, shoot the next tiger sighting. And we are disrupting forest life. So I stopped going. I said, I'm not going to add to one more crowd. But having said that, for me, the earth, the trees, the mountains, the seas, the rivers are as much a part of me as my, as you know, my blood and my organs and my, I cannot imagine a planet devoid of even one single species. So what is happening now is heart, not only heart-rending, it is utterly, it's kind of excruciating that for the sake of, I don't know, in the name of growth and in the name of profit, we are willing to burn down forests and blow up mountains because that can be turned into GDP. I mean, it's unbelievable.
It is. And
it is unbelievable. So, I mean, now, of course, I've discovered, you know, the pioneers, people like Joanna Macy and their work. David Attenborough has always been in the background with his, you know, with his movies, with his documentaries. But from a philosophical, existential perspective today, work like that, you know, Polly Higgins did, that Joanna Macy is doing, Pat McCabe, people who are talking about the earth, about interbeing, about us not being the apex species, but as much a part of the earth as any other creature, a bird or a bee or a human. We are all the same.
You know what?
So that, yeah, that's where I am.
That's so beautiful. And I kind of think about inclusion when saying that, because what's happened is there's become this hierarchy, and the hierarchy has become the humans. And we need to kind of let go of this hierarchy and come to a point of inclusion, because the earth is part of us, isn't it? It's part of who we are. Yes. And it's always the Lion King. I mean, I love musical theatre, you know, but it's just with that quote in the Lion King, you know, everything is a part of us, and we need everything. You know, we need the animals, we need the trees, we need the forest. We need the plants. We can survive if the plants are our medicine, you know. I think pharmaceutical companies have made lots of money, haven't they, on providing some medicines that are very much medicines that destroy us. But the plant, we go back to the earth and the herbs and connect with the herbs and what we have there. There is so much there to connect with. And what you said there so beautifully was that, you know, there is that whole point of destroying. People are wanting to kill the animals and kill the wild. And what do you feel like now? Because I know you're very much involved in various different projects. So what do would you suggest now in terms of what's going on? What advice would you give to some of the young people today? Because, you know, I feel that we're trying to make this world a better place for the next generation and for the young people, for your daughter, for my children. So, I mean, I suppose they could probably give us advice, to be honest with you. A lot of the time, isn't it, really, in terms of understanding, because we've already done so much, not me personally, but generationally, the older generation have done so much damage, haven't they? But looking back just with your experience, what would you say to a young person that is maybe thinking about doing something to destroy the world or destroy the planet in terms of wanting to cut down trees or has a mother that says, okay, we need to kill tigers? What would you say to that person?
I think it's very, it's crucial, it's important that we collectively, especially young, and I think young people of today are way more sensitized and sensitive and aware than we are, or we were, primarily because of the interconnectedness of the technology, the information available, but also because of the technology, on the one hand, we have information which can make you into a really globally compassionate and empathetic person, but the disinformation and the misinformation that are deliberately being seeded can also cause huge polarization and damage to the psyche, which it is already doing.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't even call it advice because I'm not wise enough to give advice. Oh. I'm learning every day.
Yes.
And I'm, you know, falling and stumbling and dusting myself off and getting back up again. But all I would like to say from my personal learning journey is don't fall for the trap, external trap of productivity and growth and efficiency and how many hours of work you did for a corporate, because that is not benefiting anyone but a few shareholders and the very elite who do not need more money. They need more heart. So can the young today really collectively rise up, and they are rising up collectively, to devote their time to what their heart calls them to do, not because someone will appreciate, not because they will get into an elite Ivy League college, not because they will get some, I don't know, Wall Street banker's job, but those are old school. No one wants them anymore, I hope.
Yeah.
but because they want to align with what is within them and they want to, you know, fulfill their innermost potential in the service of something larger than them, which is collectively beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good way of saying it. It's interesting you said, but I'm sure we all have wisdom in terms of every day we go. I think everyone has wisdom. I just want to say that to you. And I'm sure you do have wisdom to pass on. And especially because you are so compassionate. And I feel like you do have two people in this world. You have the compassionates, but you also have the destroyers. And sometimes it's for the compassionates to speak to the destroyers so they can see things in a different way, or vice versa, and without being forceful, but it's just sometimes by putting yourself in someone else's shoes or understanding what you're doing can really help to change the mindset and change people's perceptions about things that are negative. You know, that's why I call some of them the destroyers, because there are a lot of people who are destroyers that have probably maybe been brought up a certain way and have a certain belief system, and greed is almost a part of them. But then if they were there to see something in a different, from a different perspective, and to see the people who are the victims of what they've been destroying and look at it from a different perspective, then hopefully they can have compassion. I suppose that's what I'm trying to say. And I feel that's what I kind of want to do with this podcast, and want to, in terms of speaking to people, I speak about real stories, but it's about allowing people to experience other people's stories. So they know they're not alone. So they know that other people have had challenges and people get through stuff and there is light and there is no one's a guru, because I hate the whole guru status as well. I know you said quite beautifully, you know, that you're always learning. I think that's lovely, because you know, you're an old woman than myself, and I always feel I look to my elders as well. I do respect my elders, but at the same time, I do also realize that I'm always learning. And that not everybody has the answers. And sometimes you have to just reach from within and connect with people, because if someone's always got the answers, there can be a bit of a problem there. What do you feel about that, my love?
Oh yeah, I think that's a, you know, a beautiful observation, because today with COVID and everything, all systems and structures and the old narratives that, you know, the current civilization is based on, it's almost like everything is collapsing at the same time, synchronously. It's not like one system is failing. It's multiple systems failing at the same time. It's almost like we've overstretched them. They are long past their use by date. And now they're all just, they're done. So, and we are in this space where an old world is dying and the new is yet to be born. And we are in this in-between space, the liminal space. I call it the, you know, I call it befriending bewilderment. And I think for anyone to even presume to have an answer in this situation would exactly be that presumptuous.
Yeah.
None of us have the answers. And only, the only thing I know is when I use the phrase new normal very, very cautiously, because I don't think it's going to be anything like the normal that we think is normal. And it should not be. If it is, then we are heading towards a sixth mass extinction. So yes, I don't think anyone has the answers at this stage, but I'm not even seeking answers or solutions. I think where I am is staying in this in-between space, and hopefully I will be able to hold space for the right questions.
And that's,
it's like, you know, Rainer Maria Rilke said, hold space for the questions, and sometimes in the future, the answers will emerge. I'm kind of riffing off on what he said, wrote, but I think it's kind of a collective journeying towards the answers. There is no answer right now.
I think you put that so beautifully. Holding space, the answers to emerge. And I suppose I would interpret that, because I love brainstorming, when you have a group of people and you might put a question out there. And I always like, when I brainstorm, I always like to brainstorm with people who don't necessarily agree with me, because that's where the learning is, isn't it, really? Sometimes if you've got someone that feels the same way about you about something, then there's no growth there, is there? And sometimes it's good to be challenged, isn't it? Because when someone has the opposite view and different views, and you brainstorm in your mind, you can eventually come to aha moments. You know, in terms of people working together and collaboration. So I love that. Thank you so much. You've got such a beautiful energy, Sahana. It's been so lovely to have you on the show today. And thank you for sharing your story and your love for literature and your love for being a story seeker. Thank you.
Thank
I just want to say,
so much.
Oh, absolutely beautiful. And it's lovely way you've just left with that quote as well, with regards, not a quote, but with regards to holding space. That's going to stay with me. I love that. So I just want to say, from Tanya the Communication Doctor, and Sahana Chattopadhyay, adios.
Bye-bye.
From Sahana, as I reflect, as I listen, I was hearing Sahana talk about heart and head, and the heart and head needing to be in alignment as she was growing up, to kind of understand on a deeper level what was going on internally. And also this idea of the compassionate, and when I say the compassionate, I mean compassionate people, speaking to those people in the world that are destroying the world, to kind of help them to see the world in a different way and to appreciate the world and to stop building on greed the whole time. So we don't always have the answers, but if we look inside ourselves and we show up and we are open to be vulnerable, we can find the answers together.
and find the answers that benefits the nature and the earth and everything that surrounds us. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. If you would like to learn more, please visit our website at communicationdoctor.co.uk. To listen to more real stories, don't forget to subscribe.